From the Carver Center for Public Radio, this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums. Theater Square's Season 8 concludes with Hamlet. On stage now through May 4th at Walton Arts Center's Nadine Baum Studios, Shakespeare's epic tragedy is equal parts ghost story, political intrigue, doomed romance, and murder mystery. Tickets and information for Hamlet available at theater2.org. or 443-5600.
Ahead on Ozarks, how members of clergy, supporters of nonprofit organizations, and a t-shirt maker are helping spread relief for towns devastated by Sunday's tornadoes. And information about how anybody else can aid recovery efforts.
First, rescue crews continue looking for victims from the tornado that struck Arkansas Sunday night. The number of fatalities in Arkansas was revised yesterday to 15 after some victims had been counted twice. Governor Mike Beebe toured a damaged neighborhood in Mayflower yesterday and talked with officials about the recovery effort.
The search and rescue will continue until we're satisfied that everything has been checked and that people that are missing have been found one way or the other. And then I can't even begin to brag on just the volunteers. I mean, we're talking about people that just grab a chainsaw and go help somebody.
The governor says it's too soon to estimate the damage from the storm.
We've obviously got a lot of experience with tornadoes, and any tornado is bad, particularly if it's a direct hit on something. But just looking at the damage, this may be one of the strongest that we've seen. And preliminarily, we haven't done any records check, but it looks like this is the largest loss of life that we've seen in one tornado incident since I've been governor.
President Obama spoke by phone with those overseeing the cleanup efforts, vowing to provide any assistance needed from the federal government. Craig Fugate, administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, visited both Mayflower and Valonia yesterday afternoon.
Meanwhile, Faulkner County Attorney David Hoag says citizen volunteers will be welcome to help with recovery efforts soon, but not quite yet.
As long as we have emergency personnel on the scene and as long as we have power lines down, we're asking citizen volunteers to stay where they are. There will be a time, it's just not yet.
Coming up later on this edition of Ozarks, we'll have details on how to help relief efforts at this early stage.
Amid the news of Sunday's tornadoes in central Arkansas, U.S. Senator John Bozeman was released from Mercy Hospital in Rogers. Although the senator is under doctor's orders to rest as he recovers from successful heart surgery last week, he is in close contact with his office and is monitoring the tornado recovery efforts in central Arkansas.
Charges for phone calls made between Arkansas prisoners and people on the outside could change today when the Arkansas Board of Correction meets to decide on a new contract with a telephone provider. The current Department of Correction contract with Global Tel Link expires this year. Prison reform advocates say the charges for prison calls are unnecessarily high and a burden to inmates' families. Jean Thrash is with the Little Rock chapter of a group called In Mass Incarceration. She says the Board of Correction hasn't adequately opened the floor to public input before important decisions are made during meetings.
We ask if there was a comment period to where we could make comment, and the response was that after the decision was made, we could file a FOI to find out what the contract was decided. So there's really not any overt request for input from the consumers.
Shay Wilson, a spokeswoman for the Department of Correction, disagrees. She says the agency always listens to the public.
We're a public agency. Our meetings are public. We listen to the public all the time. Anyone who wants to attend a meeting can. We are a public agency, and our Board of Corrections office is open to public comments all the time. We hear from people on a range of issues routinely.
Wilson also says the 45% commission the department collects on calls funds essential inmate and security services. Last year, the Federal Communications Commission placed a cap on rates, but that only applies to out-of-state calls made by Arkansas prisoners. Reform advocates say the new rule has caused in-state calls to often cost more than the out-of-state calls.
The regional employment prospects continue to improve according to the latest data from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics. The unemployment rate in Northwest Arkansas was 5.4% in March, better than the February rate of 5.6%, and better than the unemployment rate of 5.5% recorded a year ago. Along with a decline in the unemployment rate, the overall labor force grew by about 3,100 people year over year. The unemployment rate also declined in the Fort Smith metro area. The March unemployment rate was 6.9%. That's down from 7.4% in February, and an even larger decline from March 2013, when the unemployment rate was 8.1%. While the actual number of people unemployed has declined in that metro area, so has the overall labor force. The Fort Smith region reported a labor force of 128,500 people in March, down slightly from a year ago by about 1,400 people.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals lost to the Tulsa Drillers yesterday 4-1. The loss in Springdale puts the Naturals at 8-16 on the season. The team hits the road today for four games in Springfield. The Arkansas Razorback baseball team will be in Springfield tonight, too. Arkansas plays Missouri State in what is the final midweek non-conference game of the regular season. This weekend, Arkansas plays three SEC games against Mississippi and Oxford.
Mostly cloudy tonight. Lows will be in the upper 30s in northwest Arkansas, mid-40s for the Arkansas River Valley. Clouds tomorrow, highs from the mid-50s to lower 60s. And tomorrow night, mostly clear. Lows around 33 in northwest Arkansas, upper 30s tomorrow night for the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large.
Buenas tardes a todos. Estamos de largo y yo enchado de manilaro y cubado en la academia.
Last night in Springdale, there were prayers in Marshallese, English, and Spanish, involving people from many different denominations. The prayers were at the Workers' Justice Center in Springdale, and they were for workers killed or hurt on the job in Arkansas. The observation of Workers' Memorial Day is part of a national week dedicated to making the workplace safer.
In 1989 in the U.S., it started being recognized by unions and by worker centers and by communities as a day and a week to remember people and recommit ourselves to continuing to improve safety and health conditions.
Anna Stitt is the Safety and Health Coordinator at the Workers' Justice Center. A few hours before last night's ceremony, she explained the purposes of the observation are to raise awareness for both workers at dangerous jobs and the general public.
One thing that people can do if they are in managerial positions and are sort of oblivious or think that things are fine, are to set up worker committees to actually hear from the workers, because the power imbalance is so strong in most working spaces that workers don't actually feel safe coming forward. There's a lot of retaliation, etc. But figuring out a mechanism to have worker committees who are actually given some power in the workplace to speak out about health and safety conditions, etc., to be given some decision-making power of people on the ground.
Anna says since January 2013, 32 people have suffered sudden deaths in Arkansas because of on-the-job accidents ruled preventable. A report by the National Council on Occupational Safety and Health attributes 50,000 deaths nationally each year because of illnesses or accidents associated directly with an occupation. That same report says the fatality rate for Hispanic workers is especially high, 4.2 deaths per 100,000 workers in 2012. Anna Stitt says the Workers' Justice Center uses this week to strengthen communities concerned about the safety of workers in this region.
We're reaching out to, as of the Workers' Center, we're an interfaith center, so we reach out to a wide range of communities. We reach out to workers, a lot of whom are immigrants, a lot of whom are undocumented and feel very powerless, to let them know, to do trainings, to do organizing, to let them know that they do have power, especially collectively. So our worker members will be there in the Marshallese and the Latino community, and then we're reaching out more and more to the Black and White community as well. And then also, so we're an interfaith center, we reach out to churches, both where workers who do dangerous work go, and also to allies, some of whom are in the managerial level of work, and also just concerned allies in the community who may have more power as middle-class people, and who can act from their faith or just from their convictions.
The Workers' Justice Center, located in a small building on Emma Avenue in downtown Springdale, has a half dozen staff members. The center doesn't have lawyers or staff, but can help workers connect to attorneys. And the center does offer classes and workshops designed to educate people about their rights on the job.
To go over sort of that you don't have to do work that could potentially kill you if you see that, that you don't, that you have the right to complain, that you have the right to have the company pay for your treatment if you have an injury or an accident, things like that. So to go over and help people know what the process is. That this, it doesn't have to be your reality, it shouldn't be.
Anna says the Justice Center also sent two local workers to Washington, D.C. recently to testify against a USDA proposal to increase production line speeds at some poultry plants across the country. And she says she also wants members of the community not engage in potentially dangerous work to be aware.
Thinking about how are we complicit when we're buying a chicken sandwich, when we're having our bathroom redone, when we are... when we are even leaving tip at a restaurant, like it's better to leave cash on the table than include it on your debit card or your credit card because it's easier for management to take it and not share it back with the waitresses. So even just the tiny little things.
Anna Stitt is the safety and health coordinator at the Workers' Justice Center in downtown Springdale. I talked to her yesterday in advance of a ceremony honoring people who had been killed or injured on the job in Arkansas in the past year. This is Ozarks at Large.
Pray these things in Jesus' name.
In about 9 minutes on Ozarks at Large, even if you're not sure when or if you'll retire, there are simple matters to consider about the years ahead of you.
Having experienced my parents aging, and they were fairly active, you know, healthy people, but you get to a point where you're not going to be able to move like you can now. And just thinking about, if you love your home, you love your situation, how can you sort of in the future see accommodating limited mobility?
Michael Cockrum is writing a book about sustainable retirement and will offer a free workshop on the subject tomorrow night at the Fayetteville Public Library. We posed some questions to him recently about green retirement, and we'll hear the answers ahead on Ozarks at Large.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, new music from the old 97s.
This is the ballad of drinking rye whiskey and sleeping till 2 on a warm afternoon.
The New Yorker calls the new CD most messed up, blistered, blasted, and brilliant. Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This is the ballad of anticipation, waiting and waiting and waiting.
NPR's Here and Now this afternoon from 1 to 3 on KUAF.
Eureka Springs is now an official motorcycle destination. And as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, a local alderman is working with concerned citizens to revise the town's noise ordinance to preserve what they call Eureka's quaint atmosphere and vehicular diversity.
A horse-drawn carriage filled with tourists travels Eureka Springs' historic loop lined with blooming dogwood and redbud trees. But as the weather warms, this nostalgic ambiance will be replaced by the rumbling of thousands of motorcycles. David Mitchell operates a bed and breakfast called Heart of the Hills Inn along the historic Upper Loop.
They mostly cluster like the car clubs do up on the highway. And what they do is when they can get with the motels and all there, and they can back their motorcycles in, and then they can put their lawn chairs out like they do with the antique cars and the Corvettes, and they congregate and talk and walk and do that kind of stuff. And if you think about it, the B&Bs are spread out. They're more in town, so they're not as conducive for that esprit de corps that you get with a club.
A half dozen businesses in Eureka, mainly on the outer highways, now cater exclusively to bikers, because more and more are coming with each passing season. And David Mitchell, who serves as Eureka Springs Alderman, Ward 1, Position 2, has been asked to deal with the growing cacophony.
I was approached as a council member to chair a committee of citizens, a diverse group of citizens, to look at the issue of noise.
Last fall, Mitchell selected 8 members to serve on the committee, including representatives from the city chamber and advertising agency, law enforcement, an attorney, motorcycle business reps, and concerned citizens.
This was not targeting in any way, shape, nor form a segment of our population of motorcycles. It was looking at the current noise ordinance that we had.
Which is deficient, Mitchell found, because it only addresses screeching truck brakes and loud music. And although state code prohibits noisy mufflers, Mitchell says a beefed-up local ordinance would provide local police enforcement muscle. Alderman Mitchell says Eureka's not alone in trying to calm the clamor. Cities like New York to New Orleans are struggling with ambient noise.
We looked at noise ordinances from Aspen to Key West to Hilton Head, just all the different resort areas around the country. We eventually came up with our draft and put the new ordinance out, and it goes to council May the 12th. We'll actually bring it up for its first reading.
The effort to amend the city's noise ordinance took root after Fayetteville's annual Bike, Blues, and Barbecue Festival last September, which drew 350,000 participants to the region, many taking side trips to Eureka, now an official Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue venue. While no data on motorcycle tourism in Eureka exists, merchant Mark Hughes says he's witnessed a surge since he moved to town in 2004.
That's my sewing room there that we just walked through, and then we came in here. This is the, I call it the fabric preparation and storage facility.
Mark Hughes operates Regalia Handmade Clothing in Eureka. He just returned from an out-of-town trunk show, but last winter he fled the downtown shopping district, moving up to White Street in order to escape the motorcycle racket.
You hear them in different ways all over town. My first location, they were just driving by. At my last location, they were coming up from Center Street, so they had to stop at the stop sign in front of my store and accelerate up, so I really had some noise there.
Last fall, Mark Hughes formed COPE, Citizens Organized for a Peaceful Eureka, taking out a full-page ad and placing posters around town, asking visitors to keep vehicles over 90 decibels out of the historic district, a virtual cut limestone canyon. Nearly half of all new motorcycles sold are equipped with loud pipes by popular demand. When revved, the noise can easily exceed 100 decibels. Noise above 80 decibels can have adverse health effects, according to EPA, and may increase aggressive behavior.
And I think when COPE first came together, it really was just a group of angry merchants trying to figure out something to do. And it ranged everywhere from the ones that just wanted to run any kind of loud traffic bikers out of town completely because they felt things were just being ruined. And then it ranged all the way to people whose clients were bikers that said, you really can't do that. And so I was kind of in the middle of all of these people who were just angry trying to get something done.
Merchants more than 20 years ago banded together to successfully ban large tourist buses from the downtown district. And while no one from COPE wants to ban motorcycle traffic, Mark Hughes' campaign has spurred the drafting of a new city noise ordinance.
For better or worse, it got people talking, and it lit a fire in a way.
During the half-hour back porch interview, only 3 motorcycles drove by, but soon the streets will be clogged with Harleys and Hondas. And Eureka Springs Police Chief Earl Hyatt will be watching.
I think that, you know, you've got certain people who ride a motorcycle who want to have that bad boy attitude, and they go into areas and they rev their pipes up, and it's not just in Eureka. They do it all over the place. And, you know, they think it's fun, and maybe some of the others around them think it's fun, but for the most part, people who ride motorcycles don't like it, and they don't do it.
Chief Hyatt knows this because he's a motorcycle enthusiast. He said he will stand behind a revised noise ordinance only if it does not specifically target bikers.
You can target offenders, and we will, but you can't just target a group of people as a blanket. That's just not right.
But to better keep the peace this coming tourist season, Eureka Springs PD for the first time will dispatch 2 full-time traffic officers downtown on alternate days who for now can issue noise citations based on state code. Last year, only 30 were issued, which doesn't sound like much.
Word gets around. It gets around quickly. When motorcyclists come to town, a lot of them will go hang out at certain places in town. And one guy gets a ticket, and they'll know it. And it spreads quickly. And a lot of the motorcyclists who come to town are repeat visitors. They come here on the weekends on their motorcycle, and then in the colder weather, they'll come here in their car. You know, so we're seeing the same people over and over again. Noise isn't as bad as it used to be with motorcycles. It is better. Education is the best way to do it.
Signs posted at Eureka's major thoroughfare entrances advising everyone to ride quietly were discreetly removed by order of the town mayor. He rides motorcycles. But if a new noise ordinance is enacted, new signs will go up, says Police Chief Hyatt.
At the four main entrances to the city that said noise ordinance strictly enforced.
Eureka Springs has lost population over the past decade, and opinions vary as to why. Some blame the noise, others point to a lack of affordable real estate. But tourism is reportedly up a notch after 6 years of decline. Some say it might be the motorcycles. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
There are several considerations when contemplating life after retirement: where to live, what projects, causes, or hobbies to spend more time working on, and whether to move closer to children or grandchildren living somewhere else. Michael Cockrum, an architect and writer, says more people are considering how to live greener after retirement. He's writing a book about the subject, and tomorrow evening will conduct a workshop at the Fayetteville Public Library about retirement and sustainability. It will begin tomorrow night at 6. He's the director of Bowerbird Design and taught architecture at the University of Oregon for 16 years. He's also a contributing editor for Green Source magazine. In advance of his free workshop tomorrow night, I asked him to come to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio.
One of the most important things of the whole idea of sustainable living is living on a smaller footprint. And that's often what retirees, the first thing they think about is getting rid of stuff, getting in a smaller place. It's easier to manage. So that in itself is a big step in terms of green living. And I think it's really important to think about efficient spaces that are workable, and you know, you can make some really lovely spaces without it being huge. I think in this country we have a little bit of a tendency to, you know, make these really large, grand spaces. I did my internship with Faye Jones, and his early houses, the very humble early houses, were these very intimate, often they had a little bit higher ceilings that would go up, but they weren't these tremendous grand spaces, and they were really homey and intimate and efficient.
Well, efficient not only energy in energy consumption, but efficient in how space was used.
Right.
There wasn't much wasted space at all.
Right. And the two, of course, are connected.
on the 30th, when you're giving this presentation, how will you begin? What will you tell people?
Well, I mean, the first thing is to think about how you want to live, whether you want to live in community with other people, which is, there's some very exciting models like co-housing, senior co-housing, or whether you want to, you know, live in a cabin in the woods as long as you can. So, you know, just starting to define that, and whether you can change your situation, start changing your situation now to sort of meet those goals.
But when to make or begin making those retirement decisions? Age 40, 50? What if you're not sure you know what you want your retirement to be like, or even if you want to retire at all? Michael Cockrum says even if those questions don't have specific answers, there are considerations to be addressed.
Having experienced my parents aging, and they were fairly active, healthy people, but you get to a point where you're not going to be able to move like you can now. And just thinking about, if you love your home, you love your situation, how can you sort of in the future see accommodating limited mobility?
You mentioned whether people want to live together, co-living, or in a community. Mm-hmm. I think there's some European models of that, too, that have shown us really efficient ways to do that.
Right. Really, the most exciting one to me is co-housing. It's sort of a product of it's a Danish model, and it's really pooling resources, a kind of a cooperative model where you buy a piece of property with a group of people, you kind of invest in shares of that. Everyone has their individual dwelling, and it sort of minimizes the parking. The cars are sort of pushed to the exterior. The social spaces are emphasized. But it sort of solves some of the problems that were encountered in the 60s with communes and that sort of thing, where everything was community property. And most of us found that that really didn't work so well. So you have your own space, your own sort of privacy, and then they're shared chores, you know, their landscaping is shared, their shared meals, but, you know, maybe three a week, and you can decide on when you want to do that and when you don't. So it's just a really nice model. And then with senior co-housing, there's this thing called co-care, where if you and I were to invest in that when we're 55, then you help take care of the older people when you're young. And that's sort of an investment in your own care later on by younger folks. So
paying it forward.
Right.
You mentioned cars. Is part of thinking about how to retire green and more efficient just thinking about where you're going to be?
Absolutely.
You mentioned a cabin in the woods, but
yeah.
If I don't like driving as much, my eyesight is somewhat compromised, maybe I want to live closer to public transit or where I can walk.
Definitely. You know, I'm researching a book on this subject, and you know, one of the best ways to extend your mobility is public transportation. And so, if you have a really good system that can get you anywhere you need to go, shopping and entertainment, and if there's a bus system that has a handicap accessible bus service, then that makes a huge difference. Your mobility extended for years.
There are sustainability issues to be pondered even after retirement is over.
One thing I encountered in my research was green burial. And there's actually a green burial council out there. And the ultimate act of the environmentalist would, you wouldn't think, you know, we'd want to become greenhouse gases when we when we expire. So it's an idea of, well, just simply planting people in the earth, as we've done for centuries, unembalmed, with very simple encasement. And
often in a biodegradable bag.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just and part of the idea is that, you know, when you have a cemetery, and there are special cemeteries just for this purpose, that it reserves green space. I mean, developers won't come along and hopefully and dig things up. So, you know, it's just a better way in terms of, you know, not filling the ground with toxic chemicals.
Michael Cockrum is the director of Bowerbird Design in Fayetteville, and he's a contributing editor for Green Source magazine. He'll conduct a workshop about retirement and sustainability tomorrow evening from 6 until 7:30 at the Fayetteville Public Library. The event is free, and it's open to the public. It's Tuesday, April 29th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Anne Swanecker-Hayda.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Want to guess today's theme?
Oh, this is Tuesday. Are we using alliteration?
Yes, we are.
It is Tumultuous Tuesday.
No.
Theater Tuesday?
She can see what I wrote down.
I also know you.
Yeah, that's true. You do. This is about a show at Northwest Arkansas Community College called The Giver.
Yes.
And it's based on a Newbery Award-winning book by Lois Lowry about a society where everybody is the same.
Yeah, trying to achieve this sort of emotionless utopia.
Makes me think of The Point.
Oh, I hadn't thought about The Point in years.
Yeah, what's the name of that musician?
Nielsen.
Yeah, that did The Point.
Me and my arrow.
Where everybody had a point except the poor kid who didn't. Anyway, they make example that this is like The Hunger Games and Divergent, you know, that it's
dystopia.
And the show is on one more weekend at 7 o'clock Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at White Auditorium at NWAC in Bentonville. $6 for students, faculty, and staff, $8 for the public. And if you bring a non-perishable food item, it's $1 off. All tickets sold at the door.
Very good.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Things are so bad in Iraq now. When journalist Dexter Filkins interviewed Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, their teacups were rattled by a car bomb. Iraq holds parliamentary elections Wednesday, and Filkins says Maliki is trying to dismantle any checks on his power. On the next Fresh Air, Filkins talks about his New Yorker article based on the 4 weeks he just spent in Iraq. Join us.
NPR's Fresh Air begins this evening at 6 on 91.3 FM.
Do you have high hopes for your garden this year? Many gardeners are in the process of planting for summer harvest or maybe harvesting lettuce and kale already. Just like people, insects enjoy plants. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas invited our insect expert, Dr. Donald Steinkraus, into the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss ways to deter bugs from eating your summer veggies before you do. According to Dr. Steinkraus, there is an insect for every plant.
If you grow squash, you're going to have squash bugs in this area. And that's one of our main problems, squash bugs. Have you ever grown squash?
I have not, but yeah. I know I see it all. I mean, you know, I see a lot of it at the farmer's market.
Yeah, there's a lot of different kinds. We had one variety of squash we really wanted to grow. It's called Hokkaido squash. I guess it's Japanese. And just sounded great from all the ads, sweet and delicious and nutritious and everything. But we've tried many years to grow that one. And every year the squash bugs have killed that variety for us. So we're no longer going to even try to grow Hokkaido. Instead, we've been growing this squash called Delicata. And it seems a little bit more resistant. At least we get some plants, fruit from it, which is a Hokkaido. They just killed the plants every year.
So there's really no way to deter the squash bugs from getting to that particular...
Well, there are, and we're working on it. Like, one of the things, as an entomologist, I like to do is always go low-tech first. And in a small garden... A lot of things you can just hand pick them and squash them and, you know, destroy them by hand because you don't have a lot of plants. And that's generally the route we've gone with squash bugs is we search the plants and pull the leaves up, and when we see a bug, we squish it. And when we see the egg masses, we squash them and the nymphs. The problem becomes that unless you do it every day, they just keep coming and... So there's other methods you can use to control them. They're a hemipteran, you know, that has a piercing, sucking mouth part that they stick into the plant and suck the plant juice out with. You never seen a squash bug before?
I don't know.
They're about an inch long. The adults are kind of gray. Yeah. And when you squash them, all these bugs have a scent gland in them. When you squash them, it makes a funny smell. I just squash them by hand or against a rock.
Like a stink bug.
Sort of like a stink bug, yeah. A lot of them have glands, which are defensive, so birds won't eat them. Other things, toads might not eat them.
Do they have a, a squash bug? That's not their scientific name.
Yeah, the scientific name is Anasa tristis, and they're a coreid or leaf-footed bug. There's a lot of different insects out there, and... This one is just particularly intractable. I'd say of the insects in our garden, that's our number one problem.
Is there anything you can do to control them?
There's a thing called floating row covers, which are a very light fabric that's not woven. You can buy it in rolls, and you can put it over your plants, and it just floats on top of them. It doesn't squash them down, and you can sort of weight it down around the edge, and that keeps any bugs from coming to the plant and getting on it because they hit this little covering. But light and air and water can still get through it. And that's one method people use to control squash bugs, is put that over the young plants. But you have to remove that excluding cover when the plants bloom in order that they can get pollinated, so the pollinators can get in there. You can use insecticides to control them, but I'm trying to avoid using insecticides in my home garden.
I think most people are these days, yeah.
Yeah, you sometimes have to, but I'm really trying. I just don't want to have so many chemicals in my diet.
Well, I know a lot of people like to have homegrown tomato. Mm-hmm. You know, you can just walk out to your garden and grab one and take a big bite out of it.
Right. They're good.
Sometimes you'll pick a tomato and you can see that something has maybe burrowed a hole or something into one, maybe.
Yeah. Well, there's a number of things that do that. One is there's a thing called the tomato fruit worm, which is also the cotton boll worm, and it's Helicoverpa zaea. It's a noctuid moth, and the larva, the caterpillar, really likes fruit. So in cotton, it bores into the boll and chews a hole in it and wrecks it for cotton production. That's a very serious pest in a lot of crops. And in the tomatoes, it also do the same thing. It'll chew its way into the fruit and eat it. And of course, the other one that a lot of people notice around here is the tomato hornworm or the tobacco hornworm, a great big large sphingid moth. And people call them hummingbird moths or hornworm moths. And these are big caterpillars, get to be like 3-4 inches long. And they will also chew into green fruits and eat the developing fruit because that's the most rich structure on the plant.
I don't blame them.
No. And actually, a few of them are not that bad. One principle of integrated pest management, which is a good concept, is that you aren't out to get 100% kill of the pests or the weeds or anything. You know, your goal is not absolute destruction of every last individual. And you tolerate some damage. Like that gets back to that low-tech idea I have, is that search your plants, look for damage on the plants. So when I look at my tomatoes, I always look to see, have leaves been eaten? And you can look for the frass or the droppings from the caterpillar on the ground underneath.
We started the conversation by saying that gardening really is time-consuming.
It is.
And yeah, if you want to, it's really getting out there every day. And check
well,
it for
ideally,
stuff.
Probably yeah. A person would every day is check it for a little while and work on it a bit, watch over things. Actually, a good insecticide for both tomato hornworm and the tomato fruit worm would be a Bacillus thuringiensis, BT. Now, BT is one of the organisms I used to work on in my research. It's a soil microbe, a bacterium that produces a toxin. And when a caterpillar eats that toxin, it destroys their gut, and then bacteria get into their bloodstream, and they die within about 24 hours. And it's considered an organic material when used as a spray, and it's totally harmless to us when used as a spray on the plants.
So, but this isn't something you can just go to Lowe's and get.
Oh, yes, it can. Yeah, you can buy. There's a lot of insecticides you can buy at Lowe's or at Southern Farm Cooperative or any of the sort of tractor supply companies and farm supply companies. I think that, in my opinion, that insecticide should be your last choice.
I love having tomatoes in the summertime. What is your one thing that you make sure you plant in your garden every year? What is your favorite vegetable or fruit?
I can't really say because we like them all. Like right now we're harvesting asparagus, which does extremely well here. And asparagus is a perennial and gets better year after year. We planted it about 4 years ago. Now we're harvesting quite a bit of asparagus. It also seems to be relatively pest-free. So that's a very early, delicious vegetable, and there's nothing like asparagus picked that day from your garden.
Oh, it is good. I never realized until recently that it grows just one stalk at a time, just sticking straight up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They are a great plant. If you have a garden, you're going to be there for a while, because they can last for 20 years, and you can keep harvesting. So that's our first thing right now, but we love okra. And I haven't had any trouble with pests on it. No insects have bothered us on that. So that way you don't have to worry about it quite so much.
Anything else we have to hit?
Well, there's just so many different types of gardens.
And everybody, as we were talking about our favorites, other, you know, people have their favorites, things that they like to grow. So.
Yeah. I think to have a healthy garden, you want to try to make like a small ecosystem. It's worth planting flowers, like zinnias are really good plants here. I think zinnias are just fantastic cutting plants and very attractive in the garden.
I have some right now.
Do you? Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah they're nice. And they attract the butterflies. Which is nice to watch the butterflies. I love going out in the garden seeing butterflies in there while I'm working. They attract bees. But they also attract beneficial insects, too, which will sip their nectar. So the parasitic wasps will come and get nectar from the flowers. And then they'll be there to lay their eggs in some of the pests. So trying to have a little ecosystem is really a good thing to do, I think.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Steinkraus.
Oh, you're welcome, and good gardening to you.
Dr. Donald Steinkraus is an entomologist at the University of Arkansas. He talked to Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas.
The Fayetteville Foam Fest will be held May 3rd from 5 until 8 p.m. in the Walton Arts Center parking lot in Fayetteville. This Feed Fayetteville fundraiser will feature craft beers and tastings from over 50 breweries, food, and more. Tickets are limited. More information available online at FayettevilleFoamFest.com.
KUAF is supported by ModThink, a social media strategy firm offering team-driven social media solutions for small and medium businesses and organizations. More information available on the web at modthink.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
The seasons are winding down for local collegiate athletic programs. Few chances left to see hometown teams play. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith baseball team plays its home finale tonight against Ecclesia College at Crowder Field. The University of Arkansas softball team will host Oklahoma tomorrow afternoon at 3 in Fayetteville, then entertain Florida for 3 games this weekend. The University of the Ozarks baseball team ends its home season this weekend with 3 games against Laterno University. They'll play Friday afternoon at 2 in Clarksville, then a doubleheader Saturday at noon. And the Arkansas men's and women's track teams will host the Arkansas Twilight Meet Friday on the UA campus.
The Buckyball at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art is staying put for good. The vibrant outdoor sculpture has become a favorite for visitors to Crystal Bridges and is now part of the museum's permanent collection. Crystal Bridges has acquired Buckyball, the illuminated sculpture by Leo Villarreal that has been on loan to the museum from the artist, the Madison Square Park Conservancy, and the Gehring and Lopez Gallery, New York, for the past year. Buckyball is a 30-foot, ever-changing sculpture covered in LED tubes capable of displaying some 16 million distinct colors. The light effects move through a random series of transformations guided by computer software developed by the artist. Future events related to Buckyball include a community bike ride on June 4th and an outdoor screening of the film Contact near the sculpture on July 25th. Additional information can be found at crystalbridges.org.
Due to unforeseen circumstances, Opera in the Ozarks says the Fayetteville Taste of Opera event scheduled for Thursday, May 8th at Pratt Place Barn Inn has been canceled. However, the two Eureka Springs Taste of Opera events scheduled for May 29th and July 16th at the Crescent Hotel will still take place as planned. The box office will contact ticket holders directly with options to donate the value of tickets, exchange for another performance, or receive a full refund.
The United Way of Northwest Arkansas and Huggies will host the first ever Help Keep 'Em Covered Diaper Drive beginning May 5th and running through May 16th. A nationwide study found that 1 in 3 moms struggle to provide enough diapers for their baby. The average baby uses 6 to 10 diapers every day. But in low-income households, a baby may be in a single diaper all day, increasing the chance of health problems and putting the child at risk for abuse. Parents who can't supply a daycare with a full day of diapers can't leave their children at daycare to go to work or school. Currently, no federal assistance programs pay for or provide diapers, not WIC, food stamps, or Medicare. Nonprofit organizations in Northwest Arkansas working with families and individuals in need consistently list diapers as an ongoing and high priority. The Northwest Arkansas Diaper Bank was founded in 2011 and exists to address this largely unmet need. Currently, about 830 families receive diapers from the Northwest Arkansas Diaper Bank each month. The goals of the Help Keep 'Em Covered Diaper Drive are to raise awareness around this unmet need in our community and to help provide diapers to our community's hardworking families. There are three ways United Way of Northwest Arkansas and Huggies are encouraging people to get involved in helping meet the goals of this drive. First, purchasing a pack or packs of diapers and dropping them off at the United Way of Northwest Arkansas office in Lowell or at your local Arvest Bank. Two, you can donate funds online to go directly towards purchasing diapers for the Northwest Arkansas Diaper Bank. Or three, you can host a diaper drive at your office or business. For more, visit unitedwaynwa.org/diaper drive.
Relief efforts are continuing and growing for the communities hit by Sunday's tornado in Arkansas. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis says there are any number of ways to help.
Keith Carter runs State of Mind Clothing Company in Little Rock. Yesterday afternoon, he told me that when the tornado hit Sunday night, he was spurred into action.
As things were happening, like, what can I do to help? You know, because it's not that far from where I live, you know, 15, 20 miles maybe, but I wasn't quite sure that just me going and doing something would be even the best help. And I realized that we have a very large following, you know, 18,000 followers on Facebook. You know, maybe I could do something to kind of reach out to them, because I don't have, you know, just a ton of money just to go and donate to charity, but if every one of my followers donated something, then we'd actually have a pretty substantial amount that we could give to be able to help out.
So he decided to use his business to help raise money for the recovery efforts in Valonia and Mayflower.
We decided to do a shirt design that could kind of show a unified state front, which, you know, a lot of times when these disasters and such happen, you know, we all come together as a state. So we decided to do this design that everyone could, you know, be proud of wearing and also would be very willing to donate such to the cause, to people that actually need clothing and such. And we're just donating all the proceeds that we raised from that sale of that shirt to a charity here locally that actually is out on the ground now helping people.
The shirt features a design of two hands joined within a heart that is itself within the shape of the state of Arkansas. As of yesterday afternoon, fewer than 10 hours after first being promoted on social media, the company had raised about $3,200 to give to The One Incorporated, a nonprofit organization that aims to help homeless residents of Central Arkansas. But not all relief efforts are as novel as a t-shirt raising money for disaster recovery. Caravan of Hope, based in Springfield, Missouri, has been involved in disaster response for about 15 years. After the tornadoes hit the region Sunday, the organization dispatched teams to the disaster zones in Kansas, Oklahoma, and in Arkansas. Jeff Neeney is the national spokesperson for Convoy of Hope, and he says that once the organization's crews are on the ground in a disaster zone, they coordinate with local emergency management departments, local churches, and local businesses to get a handle on what's already being done and what's still needed in the recovery efforts.
We don't want to create what we would call the second disaster, and that is people that come flooding a community with product that's not needed or not necessary and too many people and overtax the infrastructure, that sort of thing. So we go in with a very small footprint right off the bat, and then we'll use local churches to put volunteer teams together from that area rather than bring a lot of people in from the outside. And that way they are able to sustain themselves. We don't need to depend and overtax that local infrastructure. And then we'll start bringing in product.
In the first few days, Nini says that the Caravan of Hope will bring in water and food, then transition to bringing in cleaning supplies and small tools like rakes, shovels, and garbage cans once the response turns from recovery to cleanup. As has been noted by several relief organizations, including the Red Cross, Nini says that the best thing people can do to help with disaster relief efforts in Central Arkansas is to give money rather than goods, as monetary gifts create an economy of scale for obtaining product needed in disaster zones.
When somebody makes a $5 donation, they could take that $5 and go buy one case of water, and then they could bring that to Convoy's warehouse, and we could combine it with others and get it on a truck and send it down there. And their $5 would have put one case of water in the hands of victims, and that's good. But an even better solution is when they donate that $5, we can then go to corporations with enough of those donors and say, hey, if you'd like to donate a tractor trailer load of water, we will come pick it up and we'll deliver it to the victims in this certain disaster circumstance. And we can probably, for that $5, deliver 5 cases of water, or sometimes as many as 10 cases of water.
But if you do feel compelled to donate goods rather than money to tornado relief efforts, there are reputable organizations set up to take those donations as well. The United Methodist Convention of Arkansas has an online portal set up to accept monetary donations, all of which will go toward relief efforts. Also at the convention's website, which is arumc.org, is a list of items needed in the disaster zone. 3 drop-off points have been set up for donations of goods, one at the Christ United Methodist Church in Cabot, another at Grace United Methodist Church in Conway, and yet another at First United Methodist Church in Maumelle. Reverend Martha Taylor, part of the United Methodist Convention in Little Rock, says the organization has also mobilized its trained volunteers to the disaster zones in Valonia and Mayflower.
We've got a number of emergency response teams that are trained by our national organization, the United Methodist Committee on Relief. So they're trained and certified in disaster response. So those groups are already being deployed in the affected areas. And then in addition to that, we're also coordinating and gathering the names of teams that haven't gone through the training process, but still have a lot to contribute in the way of cleanup and supporting the families that are going to need to be getting back on their feet.
Taylor says while untrained volunteers aren't needed with the initial recovery efforts, she urges people who want to help those affected to wait until the communities affected begin the rebuilding process. To sign up to volunteer through the United Methodist Convention at a later date, she says you can email disaster@arumc.org. With congregations in all of the state's 75 counties, Taylor says there's no shortage of people willing to help respond to disasters when they hit.
One thing that's been interesting, even as of today, is we are hearing folks who experienced a tornado 3 years ago or 6 or 7 years ago, and now they feel like it's their turn to pay it forward. So they're already responding and saying, you know, we know you've got so much going on right now, but in a month, we want to bring a team out so we can help the community of Valonia or we can help the community of Mayflower. So it's really gratifying to see how our connectional system works so well under these kinds of circumstances.
But there are more than just these 3 organizations assisting with the response to the tornadoes in central Arkansas. For a more complete list, visit our website at KUAF.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Theater Squared Season 8 concludes with Hamlet, on stage now through May 4th at Walton Arts Center's Nadine Baum Studios. Shakespeare's epic tragedy is equal parts ghost story, political intrigue, doomed romance, and murder mystery. Tickets and information for Hamlet available at theater2.org or 443-5600.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Crosses.
Crosses. So do you ever have this phenomenon where you're driving by, you're on your way to cover something else or go to something else, and you see something very interesting and you wish you had 5 minutes to pull over?
Yes.
And find out what's... So the other day, I'm driving to Springdale to work on a story, and I'm going through Wilson Park in Fayetteville.
Uh-huh.
And over to my right, there are about 5 young people, and they have a mini trampoline in between them. And they're slapping a ball onto the trampoline. It's sort of like this hybrid of tennis or volleyball or whatever.
Huh.
And I wanted to pull over and say, what are you doing? But I had to be at this appointment.
I had something similar, I think, last week as well. Well, if anybody knows what that is... You should email us at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com because now I want to be friends with these people.
Yes, it looked incredibly fun. Looked like it might be a little bit difficult, but
sure.
But they were having a good time.
Huh.
If you have any ideas, email us.
Sure.
At ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
You will be with Christina Thomas, well, for the next several days.
Yes, you're going on vacation. It'll be fun.
For you or for me?
You'll have fun on vacation. Okay, yes. I hope you have fun on vacation.
That's the plan, yes. And I'll be back next week. Thanks for covering for me.
Sure.
And have a great Tuesday.